From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Michael Ondaatje, the author of The English Patient, has a new novel set in his native country of Sri Lanka. It's about a forensics expert doing human rights work for the UN, investigating deaths and mass murders during Sri Lanka's civil war. Also, we meet forensic entomologist Lee Goff. He studies the insect life inhabiting recently discovered decomposing corpses. By doing so, he's able to determine the time of death and other details about how a person has died. His new book is a fly for the prosecution. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Key House and Senate committees voted today to support President Clinton's plan to grant China permanent normal trade relations with the U.S. The full House votes on the proposal next week. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The vote in the House Ways and Means Committee was 34-4. Earlier, the Senate Finance Committee approved the measure 18-1. While that outcome was hardly a surprise, given the support for free trade in the Senate, the overwhelming majority on the House panel gives some momentum to normal trade status. The vote in the full House is still rated as too close to call. House Republican leaders have agreed on side legislation to establish a commission to monitor human and workers' rights issues in China. Organized labor, which along with House Democratic leaders opposes the trade measure, says the side legislation is toothless, but it is believed to be enough to win the votes of some wavering Democrats. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
A former Ku Klux Klan member surrendered to police today and was indicted on murder charges in the 1963 bombing of a black church in Birmingham, Alabama. An attorney for Thomas Blanton, Jr. said he surrendered early this morning. Blanton is one of two living suspects in the bombing, which killed four young girls. The other suspect, 69-year-old Bobby Frank Cherry, is free on bond on charges that he molested a former stepdaughter nearly 30 years ago. Both men have denied any involvement in the bombing. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced a controversial proposal to clean up the nation's diesel-powered trucks and buses. Spokesmen for the oil industry say the plan could raise the price of diesel fuel by as much as 10 cents a gallon. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
EPA Administrator Carol Browner wants to force the oil industry to remove 97% of the naturally occurring sulfur in the nation's diesel fuel. Sulfur mucks up pollution control equipment. Diesel fuel has lots of sulfur. Diesel trucks and buses now produce as much as 200 times more pollution than the average automobile. Browner says pollution of this kind has been linked to asthma and cancer. Businesses affected by the new rule say they're ready and willing to reduce the amount of sulfur in diesel fuel, but not this much or this quickly. They say the EPA proposal could bankrupt smaller refineries and make life harder for truck drivers, gas station owners, and diesel-dependent farmers. Spokesmen for the EPA say those claims are overstated. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
Officials at the Chernobyl nuclear plant in Ukraine say the facility has been returned to normal after a malfunction yesterday that forced them to cut their power output in half. The officials say no radiation was released, and a U.S. official said there's been no evidence of radiation. In stocks today, the Dow lost 165 points, or 1.5%, to close at 10,769. This is NPR. A ceremony at dawn today unveiled Sue, a 41-foot-long Tyrannosaurus rex skeleton at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. The museum paid $8.4 million for Sue, the most complete and best-preserved skeleton of a T-Rex. The museum is banking on big crowds. Chicago Public Radio's Edie Rabinowitz reports.
The Field Museum bought Sue at an auction for an unusually high sum, inflated by a long legal battle. The dinosaur is named for the fossil hunter who found her, Sue Hendrickson. The T-Rex was the subject of lawsuits and a government investigation that sent one of Hendrickson's partners to jail. The Field Museum teamed up with McDonald's and Disney to pay for the costs. Now both get exclusive rights to the casts of Sue's bones. The Field Museum's most successful exhibit so far is King Tut's tomb that drew 1.3 visitors in 4 months. It's likely that the Field Museum will surpass that. According to museum officials, they've already seen a nearly 20% increase in visitors this past year, before the Sioux era. For NPR News, I'm Edie Rabinowitz in Chicago.
Three people are dead in Ozark, Alabama, following a shooting last night in front of a crowd at a youth baseball park. Police say the gunman killed his ex-wife and her boyfriend in the parking lot of the ballpark as hundreds of children and their parents gathered for evening games. The gunman then shot himself and later died at a hospital. Police say at least 200 people witnessed the killings. Several bystanders were treated for shock. The city police chief said the murders were apparently prompted by a child custody dispute. The NASDAQ lost 73 points today to close at 3,635. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Ondaatje, is best known for his novel, The English Patient. It won the Booker Prize. The movie adaptation swept the Academy Awards. Ondaatje grew up in Sri Lanka, an island off the southeast tip of India. He was born in 1943, when the island was called Ceylon and was still a British colony. He has idyllic memories of his early childhood, but Sri Lanka is now torn apart by a civil war in which the guerrilla army, the Tamil Tigers, is fighting to secede. Ondaatje's new novel, Anil's Ghost, is set in the late 80s when the war took on a different form. Separatists and anti-government insurgents declared war on the government, and the government responded with hit squads. The main character, Anil, grew up in Sri Lanka and is now a forensics expert who works in America with the UN. She's sent back to Sri Lanka on a human rights mission to analyze the remains of corpses and skeletons and investigate whether they were the victims of state-sponsored murder. In this scene, she's thinking about war and death as she begins work on a recently discovered skeleton.
In a fearful nation, public sorrow was stamped down by the climate of uncertainty. If a father protested a son's death, it was feared another family member would be killed. If people you knew disappeared, there was a chance they might stay alive if you did not cause trouble. This was the scarring psychosis in the country. Death, loss was unfinished, so he could not walk through it. There had been years of night visitations, kidnappings or murders in broad daylight. The only chance was that the creatures who fought would consume themselves. All that was left of law was a belief in an eventual revenge towards those who had power. And who was the skeleton? In this room among these four, she was hiding among the unhistorical dead. Who was he, this representative of all those lost voices? To give him a name would name the rest.
It's Michael Ondaatje reading from his new novel, Anil's Ghost. Why did you want to make a forensic anthropologist the main character of a novel?
Well, I think what I wanted to do was write about a place where terrible murders committed against people in the present, and also to write about a place that had an ancient history. So what I wanted to do was really combine two professions to try and talk about this. One was to have a forensic specialist like Anil, who comes back to Sri Lanka and investigates some of these crimes, and also team up with an archaeologist who would allow me and the book to kind of deal with a much more ancient history of the place, not just make it a contemporary snapshot.
Some of the things you had to imagine to write this book is, you know, what it's like to watch your parents killed, what it's like to unearth bones of recently murdered opponents of a government or opponents of a guerrilla group. Was that much of a stretch for you to imagine these things?
Oh, it was a huge stretch, and it was also a terrible time to write this, you know, for me to write this book. It was not a book I enjoyed in any way. It sort of came out of necessity and in some way of responsibility to try and write about something, to give a portrait of a world that's so tragic, you know, and which we overlook from this distance in the West. It was really difficult to the point where, you know, at times I would just have to put the book away and have to kind of modify some of the violence, even though it's pretty bad.
How much time did you spend going back to Sri Lanka, where you were born, to see the impact of the civil war there?
Well, I've been going back there for the last, I've always gone back there, but in the last 7 years I've gone back about once a year for a couple of months each time. And, lived there. I mean, I didn't go out trying to hunt down the kind of stories. I was much more interested in kind of witnessing or listening to people talk about the situation of the war. You know, I didn't go there with a kind of documentary sense of trying to kind of ask specific questions or, you know, make judgments. I just wanted to kind of know what the life was like in a time of fear, in a time when so many people had lost relatives and lost in-laws.
We've had several people as guests on Fresh Air who do the kind of work your main characters do, disinterring bones and trying to analyze how the person was killed or executed and who might have been responsible for it. You also write about doctors who have to perform triage under horrible circumstances and watch, treat babies who've been shot and victims of massacres. And I'm wondering what some of your thoughts ended up being about the type of person who can handle this professionally, the type of personality that can deal with disinterring mass graves or treating babies who were shot in war.
Well, I mean, I think, again, this is everyone has a different personality. I mean, what happened with this book was the character of Garmini, who is the doctor in the emergency services, is someone who has sort of embraced his work as a way of defense, really, and his whole life, his personal life, has kind of disappeared as a result. And when I was in Sri Lanka, I met a group of doctors, and while they were able to live normal lives, they could listen to cricket in the afternoons, or they would, you know, go drinking now and then. These people were stunningly dedicated. I don't think I've ever met people like this who really has kind of separated themselves from the government, from even the hospitals, and were kind of almost like roaming in packs, like samurai in a way, healing people. And these were remarkable individuals. They were in a world of their own making somehow. And at the same time, those who are doing forensic work and doing human rights work, whether it's in Sri Lanka or other parts of the world, that, you know, there's this incredible, what was evident was that there's this incredible dedication and focus and detailed work, and yet at the same time they need to go mad, you know, in some way. In the book, they're all bowling, and they go bowling in the evenings and get, you know, go quite wild. And there needs to be this escape in some way. There was even one group I met who had invented the anthropologist's marching song, which they would sing when they were all drunk.
When you returned to Sri Lanka, did it cause you to wonder a lot what it would have been like for you if your family had stayed instead of leaving, and you would have been caught up in the tragedies that you were surrounded with there?
Well, I still do have family living there. You know, I have a sister and various in-laws who still live there. So I'm very conscious of the presence of the war in Sri Lanka. And I don't know what would have happened if I had been there. It's very difficult to imagine it. But no, when you're there, what's interesting about it is that when you go there, it's very much, I suppose, the way you discover Northern Ireland to be a place where you have a daily life, you have a civilization, you have people going to the stores and buying food, and good food, bad food, you know, and I think that society continues on from a distance of, you know, 2,000 miles. All you hear about is a bombing, so you imagine that is happening continuously. But it's one of those very strange 20th century things where a war goes on, and it goes on right alongside a civilization.
When you lived there, Sri Lanka was Ceylon, and it was still a colony. Where did your family fit in? What class were you in? What was your social status?
Well, I was a kid at that time. That was the last thing I thought about. But, you know, my family had originally come from India in the 16th century, and they'd lived in Sri Lanka ever since then. So that there was a, you know, they were, I think, originally Indian, and they married Dutch, and then they married some English, and they married Sinhalese, and so it was a complete mixture of races. I suppose the average middle class family, really. And when I was a kid there, my father, and some of this comes out in Running the Family, became quite a serious alcoholic. So, you know, the kind of family fortune sort of dwindled. And then my parents broke up and I went to England with my mother and a brother and a sister. So my father remained behind with one of his daughters. So that was the kind of history of the family. And really, when I go back now, it's really my sister and a few other friends I see. My father's dead now.
How did it affect your sense of identity to move to England and not be perhaps considered part of the mainstream there because you were, part Indian and part, part Dutch, mm-hmm. part, what are the other?
Part everything, really.
Part everything.
Well, you know, England was such a shock to me. I mean, I was 11 years old, and suddenly I was at a what was called a public school in England, which is like a private school here. And, you know, there were amazing number of rules and customs to quickly learn. And what happened was I really had to sort of forget my past in order to kind of cope with the present. But I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And it wasn't until I went to Canada in 63 or 64 that, you know, I went to university there and suddenly discovered English and writing and poetry. And that's when things changed for me. I think I was utterly lost as a teenager and then discovered a art which saved me, I guess.
My guest is Michael Ondaatje. His new novel is called Anil's Ghost. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Michael Ondaatje is my guest. His new novel is called Anil's Ghost. How did literature and movies in England compare to what you had been exposed to in Sri Lanka?
Well, I think in Sri Lanka, the main entertainment was conversation. And there were very few books we read there. I mean, the tradition of writing was not too significant, you know, among people in my family, certainly. And, you know, I think huge rumors and stories at dinners were the main kind of literary force. But it was really in England that I became a reader, and that, of course, helped me later on in my writing.
Have you since discovered a poetry from Sri Lanka and the area around it?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think there's been a lot of literature, especially in the last, say, 10 or 15 years, about you know, some very good poetry. There was a poet called Lakdasa Wickramasinghe who sadly died quite young, but he I think, was a major poet at the time. And I mean, I've been more interested in the literature of Sri Lanka, just reading even in the classical literature. There are two great ancient texts. One is called the Mahavamsa, one is called the Chulavamsa. And these are great, you know, myths and epics of the country.
When you started to read the great myths from Sri Lanka, did you understand anything about the culture that didn't make as much sense before?
Well, you know, it's like reading any kind of mythology or epic story. What is shocking and wonderful is that first of all, you have a similar violence, you know, and at the same time, it's kind of this wonderful, intricate cultures simultaneously, and it's almost like they go hand in hand. There's the old character Palipana, the archaeologist in this book, and he keeps talking about, in a way, trying to kind of not excuse the violence of the present, but trying to put into a context that this always happens. This always happens. You're going to get violence at certain moments, and we can do nothing about it. It's almost like a tradition. It's not a freak of nature. It's part of a tradition. And it's a very tough thing to accept, but this is what he sees, this historian sees.
Your novel, The English Patient, was incredibly successful, you know, a bestseller, then made into, you know, an Academy Award-winning movie. Did it make writing your new novel any easier or any more difficult?
I thought it would make it very difficult, but in fact, it didn't seem to make much difference. I mean, I thought I was going to be so conscious of that freakish success, really, success that I would not be able to kind of climb out from underneath that stone. But I began this book, Anil's Ghost, well, I began with a series of writing poetry, and then Anil's Ghost about 1993, and really have been working on this book ever since, very slowly, because I work slowly. And I was sort of able to separate, you know, the sort of carnival that went with The English Patient, and working on this book quite privately, I was able to kind of, you know, block it off, I guess.
How did you separate the two?
I know, I just kind of, I think I'm quite schizophrenic in the way I can, you know, try and keep two things in my head at the same time. And I was just able to focus on this all that time while the rest of the thing was going on. I remember after the Academy Awards, I was in Guatemala, and there was, you know, I was talking to some people who were doing human rights work there, and it was only about 2 or 3 days after the Academy Awards, and even there I was suddenly conscious of this huge gap in realities, you know. But
that is a really big gap.
It is a very big gap. But, you know, I think what happened was with the film, you know, the film had its own machinery, really. I mean, the actors were remarkable. They would go around talking about the film, and the film took off, and I really didn't have much to do with it, really. And so it looked like I was probably very busy at the time when I was busy with something else.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Ondaatje. His new novel is called Anil's Ghost. He's also the author of The English Patient. The English Patient and Anil's Ghost are set during wars. Anil's Ghost is set in Sri Lanka during Civil War, and The English Patient was set during World War II in Europe. Have you ever been in war yourself?
No, I haven't. And, you know, I mean, I think I saw when I was growing up in England, there was a kind of awareness of the mythology of war. You know, I was in England in the 50s, and, you know, all the literature, all the films, all the, you know, radio shows seem to be still reliving that kind of the adventures of the Second World War, you know, and various biographies. And I read all of these books and saw all those films. And but it was a war that in that kind of literature and art that seemed to be mostly about the English or the English and the Americans in the war. And so when I came, in fact, to write The English Patient, one of the things I discovered was the number of Asians, for instance, who were killed in the war as part of the Allied groups, you know, as well as Australians and others. And so I really wanted to try and redirect that kind of story to include people like Kip, who were there, and others. So although I haven't been part of a war, the mythology of that war certainly has been around me.
When you were growing up in England and watching movies about the war and reading books about the war and hearing stories told about the war, did you want a piece of it? Did you wish that you had experienced it? Or were you really grateful to grow up in times of peace?
Oh, I was grateful. I don't see any kind of joy in being in a war situation. I think that's crazy, you know, to want that.
You describe yourself as a pacifist. But you're a pacifist who has been immersed in thinking about war for your last two novels.
I think I tend to write about what scares the hell out of me, actually, most of the time. It's not something I'm drawn to for pleasure, certainly. You know, especially this book, it was very difficult to kind of having to deal with all these stories. I mean, I have a lot of archival material that was given and got hold of, and from the civil rights movement and Penn and from Amnesty and also talking to people who had, you know, papers of the disappeared, letters from people who were writing letters to government officials about their son who had disappeared. I mean, these are absolutely tragic, tragic stories. And all these files were there, and I would just not want to read them, and I felt I had to read them. So it was something that I felt was in some ways something I had to do and not that I wished to.
Why do you write about things that scare you?
I'm not quite sure. In a way, I suppose I write to try and get some order out of my life. You know, I mean, I think our lives are utterly chaotic and, you know, accidental. And I think in a way art does try and shape things and give you a kind of sense of order. Not that it is fully real or fully believable, but it's more believable than the false propaganda of government, certainly.
But, you know, to write this book, you not only had to imagine things, you had to go to places like Sri Lanka during war and travel around and see things. And so you were exposing yourself physically to the thing that scares you the most.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I didn't really feel in danger, but being exposed to that was bad enough.
Why would you want to put yourself through that?
Well, I think I wanted to write about it as truthfully and as intricately as I could. I didn't think I could write about it from a long way away. You know, it's not, again, it's not a question of judging people. It's a case of understanding how people are in a time of crisis. How does someone like Garmini survive working at those, you know, bizarre extremes of effort? You know, and what joy is there? Because there is a sort of kind of, there is a thrill there, not the kind of, you know, not the kind of Ernest Hemingway kind of thrill, but there is a thrill of having done something, and even if your own life is kind of has become empty, that there is some satisfaction there, and in a way, perhaps that's the only way there's some kind of hope in this book or in this world, to have at least done something like this, which has been valid.
Michael Ndaje, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Ndaje's new novel is called Anil's Ghost. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, the new novel by Tom Robbins. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Forensic entomologist Lee Goff investigates what most of us don't even want to think about. He examines the insects that inhabit recently discovered decomposing corpses. The type of insects, where they are in the body, and their stages of development offer clues about the time and place of death. Coming up, we talk with Goff about his new book, A Fly for the Prosecution. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lee Goff, helps investigate murders by examining evidence that would turn most people's stomachs. He's a forensic entomologist. He studies the insects living in recently discovered decomposing bodies. The type of insects and their stages of development offer clues about the time of death and other pertinent information. Forensic entomology is a relatively new profession. Goff has been at it since the early 80s. He's a consultant to the medical examiner of the city and county of Honolulu and a professor of entomology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He discusses his work in his new book, A Fly for the Prosecution. I asked him about the questions insect evidence can help answer in addition to time of death.
Well, time of death still accounts probably for about 98% of what we do. But we're also helpful in providing some estimates of movement of the body. You know, insects are everywhere, but you don't find all insects in all places. Some are quite specific to a particular locality. And if we find something that's out of place, we can tell that the body was moved. We also work in assessment of wounds, the response of insects to a wound that occurs while the individual is still alive when blood's flowing is quite different from the response to a postmortem wound. So we can tell if something happened to the body before death, kind of around the time of death, or basically after death.
What's the difference?
Well, in terms of the blood flowing, this is very attractive to the flies. And so they're going to come in very quickly to that particular site, begin investigating it. The females or males will take a meal from the flowing blood, and the females will lay their eggs. If the blood is not flowing, then they will not be as attracted to this particular wound. This is something that happened to the body after death. It's probably not associated with the cause of death. We find with the flies a very definite pattern of invasion of the body. They tend to go around the natural body openings initially, go to the head, looking around the eyes and nose, go down to the anus and genitals as a secondary level. And then the third choice is going to be one of these wounds where you really don't have a lot of blood flowing.
Would you give us an example of a case that you worked on and helped solve by analyzing the insect presence in the corpse?
Well, gee, several come to mind. Probably one of the more interesting ones was a woman whose body was found on the north shore of the island of Oahu. And the body, when it was found, was wrapped in several layers of blankets. They had an idea the woman had been, well, she'd been missing for about 2 weeks. They had a pretty good idea as to the location because the suspect, who was her estranged husband, in fact, tended to frequent that area, went out. When I took a look at the body, found that we had three species of maggots that were present, and we had intact pupa. Okay, this is the stage between the maggot and the adult fly. None of the pupae had emerged. So this indicated we were on the first generation of flies. Took those back to my laboratory, reared them at a known temperature, figured out that basically we had about 10 days between the time I collected the pupae and the flies had first laid their eggs, working backwards. The woman had been missing at that point for about 13 days. I could account for actually 10 and a half days of development, figuring that if you wrap something up, the insects are not going to be able to get there very quickly. And I was pretty confident with that. Wrote up a report saying that I could account for 10 and a half days of the insect activity. Chances are it was longer than that because the body had been wrapped. I was pretty comfortable with that. Medical examiner was happy with it. The police were happy with it. Prosecutor was happy with it. However, the defense attorney was unhappy with it. He had another individual, aside from his client, that he wanted to pin this particular murder on, or at least introduce evidence that this individual might have been the person who actually did the killing. So he kept calling me and calling me, and finally I reached the point I was getting a little tired of his phone calls. So I decided I'd conduct an experiment. I got a 50-pound pig, which is what we normally use as a model for decomposition, and I got a couple of blankets, duplicated the wrappings, and then I started looking for a place that was pretty similar to the area in which the body had been found. Basically, I went out in my backyard. My wife wasn't too happy with that one, but the neighbors were kind of a little leery. The dog thought it was great. And I kept checking to see when the insects would come in. Turns out it took them 2.5 days to penetrate those wrappings and lay their eggs. The 2.5 days added to the 10.5 gave us 13, which very firmly placed the victim in the company of the suspect.
So that helped you solve the crime. Was the suspect convicted?
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. You compare a decomposing corpse to a barren volcanic island that has recently emerged from the ocean.
Yeah, when you have an island that's just coming up out of the ocean, it's barren, it's kind of isolated from other things by a geographic barrier. First thing that happens is usually you get plants coming in, and they'll take root and grow. As they do, they kind of change the island a little bit. And by changing it, then they make it suitable for other plants and animals to come in. These get there, and they change the island some more. Each one of these changes is a step in succession. And the dead body is not really that dissimilar. It's usually sitting somewhere where there aren't other dead bodies around. It's a resource waiting to be exploited. And the first insects that come in are your flies. And as they feed on the body, they change the body. And those changes then make the body attractive to another group of insects that will come in, who feed on the body, and thus change the body again. And you have the same pattern of succession.
Now, you know, in comparing the dead body to the barren volcanic island, the first insects that come in feed on the body, but then insects start coming in that feed on the other insects, as well as feeding on the body, and you get this whole ecosystem developing.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating little series of interactions and things. It's very complex. You have the necrophages, they're your insects that are actually feeding on the body. Then we have the predators that come in and feed on those. Then we have parasites that come in and parasitize things. We have some that just happen to fall onto the body and aren't necessarily doing anything with it. But it's a very complicated system, and analyzing it is really intriguing. You can spend hours and get kind of lost in what you're doing. Almost forget that you're actually a dead body that you're dealing with.
Well, from the book, it makes it sound like you kind of want to forget that it's a dead body that you're dealing with. You talk about how you try not to think of it as being a person, but just something that you're studying so that you can distance yourself from it.
I think a little bit of distance is necessary. You can't completely distance yourself from it, but a little distance is a good thing, because otherwise you start getting subconsciously wrapped up in what might have happened to the individual just before they died. When you do that, I think you introduce an unconscious bias into what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. What are your tools when you're called to examine a corpse? What do you show up with?
Well, basically, I tend to travel fairly light when I go out, mainly because I'm on a motorcycle when I get there. But I have a collapsible insect net. I have my collecting kit, which consists of a whole series of forceps and various and sundry scraping implements, a couple of knives, scalpels, a series of vials, and a couple of rearing chambers. And that's pretty much it.
What do you have to do to protect your health when you're around these insects and the decomposing body?
Well, it's probably the one item that I'm always certain that I have with me that I forgot to mention because it's second nature, is I have a whole series of rubber gloves and usually some kind of a respirator that goes with me.
Is that to cleanse the air or to protect you from the smell?
More to cleanse the air. It doesn't really do too much in terms of the smell. The best thing for the smell is breathe through your mouth, because it won't get nearly as much as if you breathe through your nose.
Yeah, but I imagine you don't really feel like opening your mouth when you're around that.
Well, it's kind of a lesser of two evils. No, it's basically you have a respirator over it, so that's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you can tell by analyzing the insects in a decomposing body is where that body had been and whether the body has been moved, because there are different insects in different areas. And I imagine there's different insects in cities than there are in the country. What's the difference between the insect population that will feed on a corpse in an urban area compared to the insects in a rural area?
Yeah, we have this idea of what we call synanthropy, or a level or degree of association with humans. Many of the species of flies are going to feed on decomposing material, but some will be more closely and specifically associated with man than other species. So they're both looking for the same type of resource, but they're looking for it in different places. So you may have well, an example, one of our flies, Synthesia myonudicida, which occurs in Hawaii in strictly urban types of situations and likes to be in houses. On the other hand, we have some calliforid flies, Chrysomyia megacephala and Chrysomyia rufifaces, which really prefer to be out of doors. They don't like being indoors. Synthesia myonudicida doesn't want to go outdoors and lay its eggs on something. So if you find something outdoors with that particular species of fly on it, you know that at some point or another, this most probably was in an indoor situation and was later moved to an outdoor type of situation.
Now, when you're trying to study the insect population that feeds on decomposing bodies, the surrogate for the human body that you use is a dead pig. Why dead pigs? Are they similar to human bodies? Or
really, the 50-pound domestic pig is much more similar to a human body than you might actually think. What we're looking at really is the material in the trunk and the material in the head, and we're not worried too much about what goes on with the arms and legs. In terms of physiology, in terms of the manner in which they decompose, they're the thing that most closely approximates human decomposition. They're readily available and not all that expensive, so they've turned to be a very good animal model.
My guest is forensic entomologist Lee Goff, author of A Fly for the Prosecution. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Lee Goff is a forensic entomologist. He studies the insects living in recently discovered decomposing corpses. The insects offer clues about the time of death and other pertinent information. Now, I was interested reading your book that one of the things that you can do now as a forensic entomologist is to help determine whether the dead person had taken cocaine or heroin or other drugs before death, by studying the presence of cocaine or heroin in the insect population that's living in the corpse. Is that something that you discovered you could do?
I think that probably the original work was done by some pathologists, toxicologists, back around 1979, 1980, when they were faced with a body where there wasn't enough flesh left to actually do a toxicological analysis, but there were some maggots present. And they were able to pick up some of the barbiturates by analyzing the maggots, but it kind of sat there. With the drug problems that came up in more recent years, and taking a look at a couple of cases that I had, I began to wonder, not only could we detect the drugs, but what would be the effect on maggot development when the maggot was actually ingesting those materials.
What have you learned?
Well, what I have found is that basically, almost all the substances that we have tested, and we've included cocaine, heroin, amphetamines, the new drug ecstasy, old angel dust, and some of the tricyclic antidepressants such as amitriptyline, all of these have an effect on the growth patterns of the maggots. And in order to make an accurate estimate of the period of development, you have to know whether or not these drugs were present in the body.
One of the things I couldn't help but think about reading your book was how when you see an insect like an ant or a spider, or certainly a maggot, you never know where has this insect been before coming to my picnic or coming to my kitchen.
Yeah, that's true. Depending on the insect, you could be somewhat suspicious and worried, and other insects you wouldn't worry about that much.
Is this the kind of thing that bothers you, I mean, with everything that you know?
Not really. I think just kind of something you accept. If you start worrying about where everything is walked, then pretty soon you're going to find yourself in a position where you're becoming very paranoid.
Do you have a great respect and admiration for insects, even though many of us find them quite creepy?
Oh, yeah, they're fascinating. You take a look at them, they're some of the most successful organisms on Earth. They're remarkable. In terms of the structure, the morphology, the manner in which they survive, their developmental patterns, tremendously fascinating insects.
Now, some of the insects that you deal with are the insects that we find particularly repellent because they're found around things that are decaying and decomposing. What do you know about them that helps you admire them as opposed to just being, you know, disgusted?
Well, I think it's when you take a look at how beautifully they are constructed to perform that particular function of recycling, breaking down material, how nicely this whole thing fits into the whole scheme of life.
Tell us something about the maggot that you find fascinating.
Well, basically, you have a tremendously evolved eating machine. I mean, the only thing that this particular beast is designed to do is to feed, get larger, do that as efficiently as it possibly can. It feeds in masses. It's more efficient feeding in a mass than it is by itself. You take a look at the breathing structures at the posterior end of the body, as opposed to the head, which is, again, more efficient in terms of the feeding activities. Just magnificently designed to perform a particular function.
How is the maggot designed to feed so efficiently?
In the feeding activity, they have what you call preoral digestion. And basically what that means is that they're going to digest the food that they want and ingest that instead of just taking things in and trying to process them all inside the body. So you have salivary enzymes that are going to be secreted and a pair of mouth hooks that are going to lacerate tissue. So the laceration combined with the salivary enzymes breaks down the food that they want, and then they just ingest that. It eliminates a lot of the necessity for waste handling.
Did you ever see the David Cronenberg version of The Fly with Jeff Goldblum?
Yes, actually that was one of the better examples of fly feeding activity. It was fairly realistic with the individual regurgitating back onto the food, which precisely is the manner in which the adult fly feeds.
Do you have kids?
Yes, I do.
What do they think of your work?
Well, they managed to survive their childhood. Too many traumas in there. My older daughter has gone into communications, and my younger daughter is now at UCLA majoring in anthropology. I went horribly wrong somewhere. All the entomology that came into the house, and she's working in anthropology. On the plus side, she's planning on conducting a decomposition study down in Belize this coming summer. So it hasn't totally gone off the wall.
You know, in a lot of families, the kids try to gross out the parents by bringing bugs into the house. I guess it was the other way in your house.
Yeah, they both of them kind of grew up going out to look at dead pigs on occasion when I had to do sampling on the weekends. They kind of got used to it.
One of our producers was telling me a few days ago about an article that she'd read in which there was, like, in a forest, a whole bunch of basically dead bodies that were there for research purposes. Are you familiar with this?
Oh, it sounds like she's talking about the body farm down in Knoxville.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. It's Bill Bass's anthropological facility down there.
What's that about?
Well, he started it, I guess, back in the late 70s. And they're trying to actually explore different changes that occur to the human body from an anthropological viewpoint when they're left out. They've done some entomological work down there. In fact, Bill Rodriguez, who's with the Armed Forces Medical Examiner, was one of the students very early on working on decomposition. He did some entomological work with it. But it's been primarily an anthropological focus.
You know that kids rhyme? Our version was, did you ever see a corpse go by and feel that you were the next to die? The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, they chew your guts and they spit them out. Have you thought at all about what you want for yourself when you know, what you want for your body after you pass? Whether you want to be buried, and if you think of the insects
Well, actually, I think my plans for my body, insects haven't figured into it too much. I'm planning on cremation and having my ashes scattered in my favorite surfing spot.
That sounds good. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Lee Goff's new book is called A Fly for the Prosecution, How Insect Evidence Helps Solve Crimes. Coming up, a preview of our next program in our American Popular Song series. This is Fresh Air. That's Dick Hyman at the piano playing On Emancipation Day from the 1903 Broadway musical In Dahomey, the first Broadway show written and performed by African Americans. The principal composer of the show was Will Marion Cook, who later became one of Duke Ellington's mentors. Cook is the subject of the final edition in our series on American popular song, which we'll broadcast tomorrow. We'll be reviving songs from a period of African American pop music that is very tricky to explore because a lot of the lyrics are written in dialect and perpetuate some of the stereotypes of the time. Several of the lyrics we'll hear were written by the great African American dialect poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. Some of those songs were first performed by Burt Williams and George Walker, the celebrated vaudeville team who were also the stars of In Dahomey. Our guest pianist tomorrow will be Dick Hyman. One of our guest singers will be Vernell Bonnerice, who has explored this period in his own musical reviews. To give you a preview, we asked him to sing a song that he's performed on stage, which was originated by Burt Williams. It's called Somebody Lied.
George Washington, so history says, would never tell a lie. I wish there were more Washingtons. I do hope to die. When I was but a little boy, somebody felt my head. Says he, you'll be a president someday. That's what he said. Somebody lied. Somebody lied, you see. There never was a president that ever resembled me. Somebody lied. As plain can be. Somebody lied. As sure as you born, somebody falsified to me. When I first started out in life to be a president, I got a livery stable job. This wasn't worth a cent. Somebody said, there stands a mule, go curry her for me. Don't be afraid of her hind legs, she's gentle as can be. Somebody lied. Somebody lied, you see. That mule just twisted in her stall and handed me one, that's all. Ooh, somebody lied. As plain can be. Somebody lied. As sure as you born, somebody falsified to me.
That's Vernell Bonnerice with Dick Hyman at the piano. I really like the way you do that. It's really very funny.
Thank you.
Now, Burt Williams, who originated that song, gives a lot of people trouble because he performed in blackface. And in 1906, his vaudeville partner, George Walker, wrote something really interesting about Burt Williams' blackface performances. And this is from an article George Walker wrote called The Real Coon. But now, would you read us an excerpt of that article?
Sure. The blackface white comedians used to make themselves look as ridiculous as they could when portraying a darky character. In their makeup, they always had tremendously big red lips, and their costumes were frighteningly exaggerated. The one fatal result of this to the colored performers was that they imitated the white performers as darkies. Nothing seemed more absurd than to see a colored man making himself ridiculous in order to portray himself. My partner, Mr. Williams, is the first man I know of our race to attempt to delineate a darky in a perfectly natural way, and I think much of his success is due to this fact.
Bernard, what's it like for you to be interested in a period of music in which you have to confront things like blackface and dialect lyrics?
It's part of my own education as far as theater history is concerned. When I went to college, there was no such thing as black theater history, so groups of us had to find every morsel that we could in order to educate ourselves and become stronger in knowing our own history. So for me, every time I find new material, things that I haven't got my hands on, it's wonderful because it's education. Edutainment.
That's Fernel Bonnarice. He and pianist Dick Hyman will be back tomorrow for our program on composer Will Marion Cook. We'll rebroadcast the complete American Popular Song series Mondays beginning in July. We'll close today's show with Will Marion Cook's song Swing Along as recorded by Paul Robeson in 1933. I'm Terry Gross.
Swing along the lane, lift your head and your heels mighty high. Swing along till I'm tain a gonna rain, sun's as red as the rose in the sky. Come along, Mandy, come along, Sue. White folks watching and seeing what you do. White folks jealous when you're walking two by two. So swing along, children, swing along.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. From Putumayo World Music, presenting Miriam Makeba's new recording, Homeland and South African Legends, a collection featuring Johnny Clegg, Hugh Masekela, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and others. Information at www.putumayu.com. And from Random House's Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Patient Number One, a true story of how one CEO took on cancer and big business in the fight of his life, by Rick Murdoch and David Fisher. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our series on American popular song concludes with the music of Will Marion Cook, the principal composer of the 1903 Broadway musical Indahome, the first Broadway show written and performed by African Americans. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.